welcome to the 8th episode of Tales for the East, a podcast series from Deniston, Sighthill and Hack Hill in Glasgow's East End. Although today, we're actually going to go over the border and talk about a very special individual from Dole Cross. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alistair Satchell, and I'll be your host for this series. This episode is a conversation about the life and adventures of leading rally driver Andy Neal, with her children, Candy and Donald. Andy, or Annie, and her sister Chrissy, or Kiki, were born and brought up in a pig farm at Dole Cross. Andy never sat a driving test, yet she drove trucks for the pig farm and competed in rallies, including the Monte Carlo Rally. We talk about her life, the pig farm, her family, memories of Dole Cross, the politics of land ownership in Glasgow, a firearms armistice, and many more things beside. Before the conversation started, Candy, Donald and I talked a little bit about how poor my internet connection was, so you'll hear that referred to at a certain point in the episode. Needless to say, the connection improved once my son stopped playing Apex Legends on the Xbox. To get us started, we talk about Candy and Donald's lives, and then go into the story of their mother, Andy's life. As we recorded this conversation over Zoom, such is the way of things nowadays, there are, of course, the occasional weird bleeping and bipping noises. I've tried to edit them out where possible, but some remain as ever. So, without further ado, I hand you over to Candy and Donald. Who are you?
You start, Candy.
Okay, right. Well, I'm Candy Monroe. We were both born in Dumfries, but we moved, our mother brought us back up to Glasgow from where Dolph was just a baby. And I must have just been two. So we grew up in Dole Cross. I lived in Dole Cross till I was, oh goodness, late 20s. And then I've moved about a bit, went to London, California. I keep saying I've left Glasgow twice and come back twice.
Yeah.
So I live in the West End now.
What were you doing in California?
My ex-husband was offered a contract out there. And it's one of these things, like, do you want to go and live in California for a couple of years? There's only one answer to that.
Yeah.
So it was a great experience. Unfortunately, I couldn't work. I couldn't get a green card. So we ended up coming back. As I say, I keep coming back to Glasgow. It's a great place. And I worked in the Gorbals for many, many years, which is you're talking about the communities and the connections. I mean, it's a fascinating community, the Gorbals. And, you know, I worked there for about 15 years, absolutely brilliant. And latterly, I've been working in the education sector, so allegedly retired, but still working. That's the thing about lockdown, is they keep asking me to do, because I'm just doing consultancy work, and they just keep asking me to do more. So, you know, what else are you going to do during lockdown?
Donald, how about yourself? Who are you?
Well, we're not talking about the internet. I work for Openreach.
Ah, fantastic. Well, you know the perils then, yeah.
So you should be getting fibre to the premises hopefully soon. That should be hopefully coming over. We're doing a lot of work with that just now all over the place. So I've been with the post office, BT, telecoms. They can't get rid of me. I've been with them about 40 years now. So it's about 41 this year, actually. So I've seen a lot of changes, to say the least, and especially in technology and all that stuff now. And I was quite interested in the fibre towards the end, so that's what I'm doing at the moment. So, as you know, it's a big thing, especially for the islands. It should have been done many, many moons ago, or even a better infrastructure. But now, hopefully, this is the way ahead, or this is what they're putting their eggs in the basket, as they say.
Starting with the GPO, what were you when you joined the GPO then?
Well, we started, it was a kind of course that they did in those days. That you went into the exchange, you did a couple of years in the exchange, and you wired up the exchanges for external. And then you either went one way or the other. You either went to the overhead sections or you went to the, what they call the underground. In those days, it was like a wee bit like, I think, the council. It was a demarcation. You did this, you did that. You didn't mix it. And then years down the line, that they decided that we all thought it should have come, but basically, supposed to send one engineer out that did one job, I can't do the whole job. And that's where it's transpired. And it kept going that way.
Were you involved in them fixing the big outage that was on in Deniston recently?
It blew it did actually take the fibre, but it's what we call a team called FND, and they work like 24/7 for it ended up, there was a water, well, according to the power company, it was a water that went into theirs in blue. But it was in a very specific bit that basically took all the cabinets, you know, the fibre to the premises, it took all those cabinets out. It was quite a big one, but given their due, they just flung everything at it. Because it was, as usual, it's not a 5-minute job. So they did well to try and get it up, because it's right at Abercrombie Street. It was quite a blast. Somebody described it as like a war zone when it actually, probably just as well nobody was nearby when it went off, because it could have caused serious injury. But back to the old nature of Scottish weather, the water's been seeping into the ground, so it goes somewhere. And it definitely found the power cables. But there've been a few couple of things, but that was quite a big one recently. I think it was like 12,000 people out or something. And of course, with the lockdown, it didn't go down too well, because a lot of people are working from home. That's a big thing.
So. And instead of Netflix, you got Notflix.
That is it. And no coordination streets. So maybe that was a bonus. Well.
Yeah. We've focused in on Denniston, Sighthill and Haghill. So Toll Cross. So I wonder if you could explain to the listener, why am I talking to people from Toll Cross? What's your connection to Denniston in the area?
Well, my wife works, she's been working there for the last 35 years. She works for Regional Housing, as you know. So she's got to know a lot of good friends and people that obviously started off Regional Housing Association. She was very friendly with them. Sadly, John Butterley and I mean, it is a total community, and it is a very community-based place, as you know. And it's the people, it's just like everything else, they're friendly and willing to help people. And hopefully that's going to stay over the years to come. But that's it. And it's very like Toll Cross as well. Toll Cross was a very small community, but same thing. Everybody knew each other. I mean, the wee dairy come shop as a candle, like, you know, Jenny Dougal was her name. She was like the oracle. She knew things before they happened. I mean, you could go. and she was one of the old ones that wouldn't change to decimalisation. She'd still right up to the end. She would, and she didn't have a till in her shop. She actually had to draw with the wee wooden bowl things in it, and that's how she worked. Worked in the old ways. But
I think even to an extent now, because Donald lives up just up the road in Sandy Hills. Toll Cross was always a village, and I think a lot of these communities did see themselves as villages. So, I mean, I suppose what you had was like Dennis, I'm thinking of geography, Denniston, and then you sort of going into Shettleston, and then Toll Cross. And Toll Cross was the last, and Toll Cross was right in the border of Glasgow going into Lanarkshire. So, it was the last community as you left the city.
It was the last boundary into, because the actual Lanarkshire border is at where the pig farm was. There's a burn there, I think they called it the Bloody Burn, if I remember right. And that actually is the demarcation, because you could come out of, well, when it was a pig farm, or still when my mother stayed there, you could turn right and go down the hill, and the sign for Lanarkshire was there. And that was in the middle of a street. Mm-hmm. So
it's true.
So you mentioned your mother. Who was your mother? Where did she come from?
My mother and my aunt were born in the house in the pig farm. So my grandfather came from Gourock, and my grandmother came from Easdale. And my grandfather built the pig farm. He was a flesher by trade. So they must have got married. I'm not sure the date. I don't even know if I've got it anywhere, but they must have got married in very, very early 1920s, because my mother was born in 1924. And my aunt was born in 1927. So my mother left briefly when she got married, 1956. But that didn't work out. So she must have come back around about 4 years later. So my aunt lived her whole life in that house. And my mother lived most of her life in that house.
Amazing.
It's called Haydale.
Haydale. Because my grandfather's middle name was Hay. And my grandmother's maiden name was Clydesdale, so they put the names together. So that's why it was Haydale.
And where was the pig farm? Whereabouts in town?
It was a big plot of land in the corner of Corbett Street and Easter Hill Street. I mean, at its peak, my grandfather, I think, had over 1,000 pigs. I mean, it was a big pig farm.
Gosh.
And of course, when the war came along, my mother was desperate to leave school. So she left school at 15, I think, and worked in the pig farm and went to... The irony is my mother became a rally driver. She never passed a driving test. because she learned to drive in during the war when she was 15, driving the trucks for the pig farm. So, you know, at the end of the war, there were so many people that had done that that there was no way we could put everything through a test. So Kiki would have been a bit younger. She was evacuated up to Lochry during the war. But yeah, my grandfather had a big pig farm, and then must be in the early 50s, my mother decided she had an interest in motorsports and rallying. So she took herself off and signed up for a rally and came home and told her sister, who didn't drive, by the way, we're doing this rally and you need to learn to drive. Because even though Kiki, or Chrissy was her real name, we called her Kiki, even though she was going to be the navigator, she still had to have a driving license. So she had to do, that's the wrong word, one of these 1 week crash courses to get her test.
Ironically titled Crash Courses, yes.
And they won lots of, they did the Scottish Rally, the Morecambe Rally, and then Mother and Kiki did the Monte Carlo in 1954 and 1955. And then my mother was expecting me in 1958. So my aunt Kiki and my father did it. You know, I mean, the Monte Carlo is in February. I was born in February. You know, there was no faint-heartedness about it at all.
That's amazing.
Between us, I mean, they kept all the rally plates, and when my mother passed, all nice, because obviously there's two rally plates, one at the front, one at the back. So we split them, so we've got all the rally plates, which is really nice.
Amazing.
And they were very well known at the time. I mean, they were sort of like minor celebrities. I've got loads of newspaper clippings about them, and there were characters.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's safe to say. Yeah.
Yeah, very active in the Lanarkshire Car Club. And I suppose after my mother had myself and Donald, she gave up the big competitive. I mean, it was always amateur. But they did local rallies, but they gave up the, you know, doing the Monte Carlo and the Scottish Rally and these big ones.
What was the appeal for her? What was it that about rally driving that appealed to her at such an early age as well?
I think probably the adrenaline, you know, and something. They were quite, you know, two women and two sisters doing these rallies was quite unusual. I mean, it's not, there was quite a lot of women rally drivers, but having two sisters, and they're very glamorous. I mean, I've got pictures of them at the end of the Monte Carlo, when they've driven for 3 days, they've had hardly any sleep.
Wow.
And they look more glamorous than I could ever possibly look, as if I'd spent a whole day in a spa. But the 1950s was a very glamorous era. But I suppose, I mean, Donald can make comment. I think my mother was quite a tomboy, even though she was very glamorous. You know, she worked in the pig farm, and she was always very, very proud that she could lift as much weight as any of the workmen.
Brilliant.
Because my grandfather also had an edible fats business as a sort of byproduct, and supplied, you know, a lot of chip shops and restaurants in the East End. And it was dripping. It came in these 100-weight boxes. Like, that's 8 stone. Yeah. And they would lift, you know, these. So she was always very proud of that. And Kiki worked in the office. Yeah, they were pioneering in many ways. I mean, I think if anybody had said to them, "Well, you can't do that, you're a woman," that would be a reason to do it.
Yeah, I think the thing was, it was very a male-orientated businesses all around, even the pig farm. Whereas, Lisa told Cross again, being a kind of close-knit community, they just buckled in and didn't bother if a mother was side by side with the guys, you know, working away, because that was the way it was. And it had to be done that way. It was a hard business. I mean, we were still quite young growing up at the time. But it would be unusual at 2 o'clock in the morning. You'd be out to a sow is maybe farrowing, and the piglets and all that stuff. So you kind of learn the hard way. And it was sadly that the pig farming, it wasn't just because pig farms and a lot of farms were going downhill because of obviously abroad, but it was just sadly what happened, because my grandfather became ill, and I don't think it was actually recognised in those days, but it was either dementia or early senility. It was a shame. So my mother actually spent a lot of time looking after my grandfather, and so did my aunt. So it was same thing with the family. It was a very close-knit family, but it was sad to see the kind of demise of a pig farm and the way it went, because of just my grandfather being ill. And my mother was very loyal to the family, so she kind of threw a life at it, basically. Mm-hmm. So just the old-fashioned way of I suppose, mothers in those days, and especially my aunt as well.
Because I think it must have been the late 60s. I was trying to think of the date, but I think it must have been the late 60s when, you know, they eventually decided they had to basically sell up that side of the business, because it was, you know, caring for my grandfather was 24/7. Hmm. Caring for the pigs was 24/7.
Oh, yeah.
You know, something had to give. But what they did, yeah, again, they were very enterprising, because with all this land and outhouses, so what they did was they let out the space. So it almost became a sort of mini, not quite an industrial estate, but, you know, we had mechanics. There was a cooperage moved into one of the big sheds. In fact, Old worked the cooperage for a while. Mm-hmm. There was joiners. There was a cosmetics company. I mean, wow. It was, you know, it was quite a nice... So, you know, although they had to give up the pig business, they set up another business. I mean, it was a great childhood. I mean, it was amazing. Because you, you know, you had all the space to run about in, the pigs.
Plenty of cats.
Lots of cats.
Like 24 cats at one point.
What?
Yeah.
Because you had them outside, inside, they just had a free range. And a certain person was speaking to just now still likes cats.
That's me. But there was a lot of working cats, because obviously you had to keep, you know, vermin down.
It was always a case that my mother would, you'd hear the door going at night time, my mother would be talking to somebody at the door, and you knew straight away it was somebody bringing a stray in. Mm-hmm. And my aunt used to say, if they came with a cat wrapped in a scarf, the person would leave with the scarf and we'd have the kitten. And that was always the case. My mother couldn't turn anything down, and it was strays, and God knows some of them were. I mean, but the other good thing was, through the years, my grandfather being in the market, he had a very good friend called Nicol Nicholson, wasn't
he? He was the chief vet.
He was the chief vet. So, I mean, their friendship came up through the market.
Wow.
So, and then with actually another vet, Boyce out in Clydebank. So they became friends as well. But, I mean, if you went for vet bills nowadays compared to those days, half the bills never even, you'd be bankrupt just by the vet bills.
Yeah. So what's quite interesting is my next-door neighbour is a nurse, and she was a district nurse round about the East End. And she'd heard for years, working across these communities, about this pig farm in Corbett Street. And then all these years later, I move in to this street right next door to her.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was really strange, when they built a care home on Toll Cross Road, oh goodness, it's probably about 20 years ago, and they called it Haydale, and we couldn't work out, because by that time, and I'll tell you that story, but by that time Haydale was gone. And I wrote, and before I really emailed, I wrote to them and said, look, we're really interested, because, you know, this is a family history and that was the name of the house. And what they said was, these, when they were building care homes, they scoured local ordnance survey maps, old ones, to come up with a name, because a lot of the people that are in these homes did live in the local community. Their memories, they always tried to pick a name that meant something.
Lovely.
I think it was two brothers that owned that house in the care home. I think they sold it off later. But it was a nice touch that they did that. Yeah, and they owned up a home in a local area.
You can ask what happened to Haydale.
Yeah, but please carry on, though, what you were going to say.
It's quite wicked, actually. The district council at the time, this is long story short, the district council at the time decided they were going to rezone the land as industrial, and they put a compulsory purchase order on the house and the land. And of course, my mother and my aunt bought it for years.
There
was a lot of emotion involved in the house, because obviously they've both been born in the house. And to be quite honest, Toll Cross didn't need a light industrial zone. So they fought it and fought it. The wicked thing that the district council did was they were able to evict all the tenants, because they'd put a compulsory purchase order on the land. So basically overnight, they took away the business income. And then towards the end, when, you know, my mother and aunt could see the writing was on the wall. So when the house needed a new roof, they didn't put a new roof in the house. So when the council came and put a valuation on the property, they marked the valuation down, because, like, it didn't have a new roof that it needed. It was absolutely wicked. It was wicked, wicked, wicked. Because at the time, I'd just get married when it eventually came down and they'd appealed and they couldn't appeal anymore. And I bought a brand new house, a starter house in Tollcross, a two-bedroom semi-detached. What they paid for Haydale, which was three public rooms, two bathrooms, four bedrooms, was the same price. It was absolutely,
cruelty. It was cruel. But they did it all over the place. And it was the way they did it. It's not getting into politics, but it was like they were showing their muscles. They'd send chauffeur-driven cars down with councillors in it just to put padlocks on businesses outside and basically warn them, if you take the padlock off, you'll get arrested, and then it'll be down. It really was. It was victimisation, really, as well.
And what was worse, by this time, my aunt had passed. And to this day, I'm still convinced. Sadly, she developed cancer, but I think she gave up because there was no way she wanted to leave that house.
No.
It was a few years later that eventually my mother had to move out. They did nothing with the land or the house for about 20 years. So my mother moved locally. She watched the house crumble.
Yeah,
vandalised, vandals set it on fire, and eventually they demolished it because it became unsafe.
Yeah.
But the land was derelict.
It was left.
Have a compulsory purchase order slapped on not just your home but your business, you're evicted, you get a very poor value, and then the land lies derelict for more than 20 years. After probably about 10 years, I went to the council and said, right, you put a compulsory purchase order on this land to make it a light industrial area, and you have done nothing with it. I said, I will buy the land back. And there is they've got a formal multiplier, they had a multiplier because the compulsory purchase order was served in 1984. My mother didn't move out for a few years. So the value that was put on it in 1984, they've got an incremental value. So I said, right, the value that you paid in, what did mother move? Picking 92, my mother, the house was that when she moved. I said, so I'll happily pay that incremental increase. And they came back to me and said, well, if we ever sell it, we'll let you know, and you can bid in with it along with anyone else, which I thought was disgraceful. Actually, I took legal advice. I was going to actually take them to court, but because this had never been done before, somebody trying to reverse a compulsory purchase order and buy the land back, it was going to have to go to the court of session.
And yeah.
When you're up to
£100,000 already.
Oh, yeah, it was just like I thought, it's too big a risk.
Yeah.
By the time Tollcross Housing Association unwittingly came in and didn't know anything about this and approached my mother, and my mother phoned me one day and she said, I've had the Tollcross Housing Association. I said, what's this? They came down, they saw the land, they wanted land, and they basically said to my mother, and my mother hadn't explained it to them yet, they said, well, what we'll do is we'll take over the land round about you. We'll upgrade your house as much as we can, maintenance, and basically build round about you, because they were looking for housing. And then, of course, we had to give them the bombshell that basically it was under compulsory purchase and it had been like that for years, and it was getting quite nasty with the council. And, of course, they had to back off because basically they did approach the council, and council basically told them, beat it, basically, this is theirs. And as Candy said, the day of the house, I took the keys into the council, and fair enough, it's nobody's fault. Went in, I put the keys down in the desk, and to this day I can't remember the guy's name. He came out and I says, well, you better get the house shuttered up. They made safe tight, as of tonight it'll probably get vandalised. As it is, and within 3 days the first fire was set in it, and that went on, as Candy says. And then one night I went down and the fire engines were there and the fire chief was there, a really, really nice guy. Got talking to the fire chief and I explained him to what the situation was, and he actually explained to me, he goes, this is not the first in the east end of Glasgow. He says, we spend so much time going round places that have been compulsory purchased, vandalised, set on fire, and we're wasting so much time in it. You felt so sad about it because you're standing there watching what my grandfather built, what was left of it going up in flames. And it had been a solid house, because in those days when they built a house, they built a house type of thing.
Oh my goodness, yeah, totally.
And of course, what happened in the meantime was a lot of private housing developers have moved in to the East End. And the house I bought, you know, a new build, and what I was going to, I mean, in the end, Tollcross Housing Association, it was Tollcross, it was social housing, but I'm sure it's Tollcross. They did buy the land and they did build. And that's the only thing that makes me feel a bit better. At least it went to social housing and not, you know, the council selling the land at a huge profit to private housing developer. But you just, it's just one of these wicked stories. It should never have happened.
There's so much within what you've said that like to pull apart and kind of go into in more depth. I mean, let's. I think I'll start off, if it's okay to ask about the cars. What kind of cars was she driving in their sister driving? Was it sort of Triumphs or what was?
Their favourite car was a Morgan. There used to be a vintage and veteran car rally that went from Glasgow to Largs every year, and they had a friend called Sword, John Sword. He collected veteran vintage cars. So we, as a family, the four of us, used to dress up every year. And it was I remember that one. That was a 1912 Vulcan. We'd be in the white dusker coats and the hats. Amazing, totally amazing. So they had a variety of cars. And then at one point, my mum did have a driving coach, and this coach had said to her, right, the next car you need to get is a Morgan. Now, even then, Morgans were... there was a waiting list, nothing like the waiting list that is now. But the story was that my mother was doing points tests at a rally she was doing. And so you do the rally and then there's got these driving tests. And Peter Morgan, who was the father, saw her. And he must have heard somewhere that, you know, she was on the waiting list. And he said to her, right, the first one that comes off the production line is yours. I mean, obviously she had to pay for it. Yeah, it wasn't a free car. But
wow.
I mean, obviously it was good for them. And when it came off, it was British Racing Green. And my Aunt Kiki had a real thing about green cars. So I think they did the first rally with it as a green car, and then it went back to the factory and they had it, because the Morgans are hand-painted white. They called it Toots. And the number plate, if I've got a picture here, if I did find this picture earlier on, see if I can put it up. KYS for one, so it was Kiss for one. I don't know if you can see that. Can you?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, that was a board, and that's my grandparents and mother and Kiki. So,
oh, that's gorgeous.
So that was their favourite car. What I'm trying to think, what they were doing the Monte Carlo in
Vanguard. God, that was the Vanguard, because we've got good pictures of that as well, the big air horns on it, and then down at Paris, well, down at the main ports and all that stuff. But my mother for years hated seatbelts. Absolutely detested seatbelts. And she was actually, her story tells that, I don't know what car it was, but they were doing a rally somewhere and she overturned the car and ended up in a river. It turned out later on it was not just a river, it was a burn. But as my mother said, it sounded better, it was a river. So that's why she never wore seatbelts, because otherwise she might have drowned. And to this day, well, sadly, she's away now, but she'd phone me every so often and say, I got stopped by the police again. I was like, why not wearing my seatbelt? And because it was East End of Glasgow, half them knew her and just went, just got up the road and put the seatbelt on. But one night she actually got stopped in Welshert Road, and it was a big burly sergeant who didn't know her. And basically, why are you not wearing the seatbelt, madam? And she said, oh, no, no. I said, I must have forgot. She'd been very polite. So he grabbed it and he yanked it. And it was an old kind of battered up car. And basically broke the seatbelt. My mother went, take it, that mirror not working. Does that mean I don't need to wear it? And he just sent her up the road. She always had an answer for things. And she came up the road, she goes, yes, I think the sergeant broke. I said, it probably broke before he even touched it, because some of the cars towards the end, my mother ran. It was like the Flintstone stuff. You could see the road.
I've got some brilliant pictures. There's one at the starting line. I can't remember what rally it is, but it's, they said it's a Morgan sandwich, so there's three cars in the starting line. There's two MGs and the Morgan in the middle. It looked really good.
What kind of size were the engines in the Morgans and that?
I think the Morgan still had the Ford engine in it. It was a plus 8 and a plus 4, but Mother's was a plus 4. I take it, I think the plus 8, I don't know if they're still. There was a great programme on about the Morgan about 10 years ago, because evidently the Morgans are still built with the wooden chassis.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Supposedly. And the production line, there was some company, it was a famous guy that used to go into companies, and if they maybe needed maybe a bit of kind of direction going into the kind of inverted commas modern world, and they went to Morgan and basically said there's nothing you could do for them because basically they are efficient. And he says, look at their waiting list, it's like 4 or 5 years for a Morgan. I mean, basically saying now, if you buy a Morgan brand new, you could put it back in the market straight away the next day and make money on it.
They're built because they're so popular. My mother passed in 2004, and it must have been like a year or two beforehand. And I can't remember how I came across this, but there was basically the Morgan was still on the road, and it was a guy down in the south coast of England had it, and he had a company called, I think it was called Rambling Roadsters. And he had these classic cars that people could rent. But of course, it's still the original number plate. And I was saying, I've actually still got a set of keys for it. And I got in touch with someone because he tried to put together the history of the car. And he'd only got, because I think the car was, I think it was 1954. And he'd got so far, and he had been told it was a rally driver that had it, but he couldn't find out anymore. So he was delighted, and he was going to bring it up because one of his kids was at university up here, but he said I can only come up in the summer because the car wouldn't do the journey in winter. But then sadly the winter passed and then mum passed, so it never actually happened. But you know, up until then that car was still on the road. It's amazing that when they're built to last. But yeah, my mother she drove like a rally driver up until her 70s. We eventually persuaded her not to drive anymore.
There's obviously so much more to talk about. The pig farm as well is so interesting. Like, so the market for pigs, was it a slaughterhouse as well? Was it, or did what?
The pigs went to the meat market in Denison.
Right.
It was on Duke Street.
And a massive pig place.
When we were kids, that was brand new. And Dog was talking about Nicol Nicholson, the chief vet, where he was involved in the design of that. Now it's been knocked down, and I think there's going to be, I don't know whether it's housing, but yeah.
Developed now again.
Yeah, there was a, although my grandfather was a flesher to trade, the pigs went to the market.
He became a deacon of Glasgow.
Yeah, he was
in the trades house.
In the trades house.
I've still got his medal upstairs with all the was it the fleshers? I can never remember them all, but all the trades within the meat market. And I've still got that one with his name on it and way back then. But the meat market as well, I can remember going to the meat markets for the candy. The float we had was an Albion truck. That's the thing my mother used to drive. And you used to be able to take the float off the back of it. And it was all pulleys. Take off and it turned into a truck. And then when the meat market came there, you went in there. And to this day, I can still remember going into the meat market. It's not for the faint-hearted.
Oh, I hated that.
I mean, I think the animals knew they were going to the meat market. It's one of these things that you had to have a strong stomach for.
And that was it. I mean, I think on a Friday, when we were coming home from school on a Friday, my mum would pick us up and she went into, because you know, there was no such thing as bank transfers. You went in and got your money. So that's was one of the stops on the way home from school on a Friday. And I remember that, and I remember the smell of it. Oh. And I'll hold my hand up. I'm vegetarian. I've been vegetarian for 30 odd years.
And I'm definitely not.
No, you're not. You make up for me. But yeah, I remember as kids, I would get really upset, you know, when the pigs were being put onto the floats. I hated it, absolutely hated that.
I gave Toll Cross a laugh as well, because some nights we'd be sitting in the house and the door would go and the police would be at the door. And of course, it was police and the bikes, you know, the old cycle bikes. Do you realise there's pigs running about Toll Cross? And it's maybe some of the local kids would come in and undo the pens and let the pigs out. So the police would give you a hand, you'd be out in Toll Cross Road or you'd be up the east of Hill Street, pigs are running about. It was a sight to behold, you wouldn't think that was in the east end of Glasgow.
This is where the traffic in those days wasn't like it is now.
Right, definitely.
Where did your grandfather and your mother sell the pigs to? Where did they go from the meat market into the marketplace around the town from there? What was the economic structure of it? How did it work?
Oh, I mean...
They had an edible fat side of it that basically they used, it sounds terrible, but the pigs came to make edible fat. But my mother used to say any time the pigs went to market, I mean, my grandfather was a flesher, but he was a fully fledged, you could take what they called a beast in those days and shemane and put it down and carve it up wherever you wanted. But for some reason, my mother would never take anything off the farm. But that fell away by the wayside. It wasn't really an industry for us. Everything went to the market, really. That's mm-hmm. all it went to. And it went into probably what they call the food chain, I suppose.
Yeah.
My mother used to joke about it. She wouldn't take anything off the farm, but the local butcher up the street, she'd go and buy bacon off of, and it probably came back round in itself, but as she said, mind over matter.
But she never had pork in the house, because I can remember her telling the story, and I think it might have been before we were born. Mm. They were having a meal, and it was pork, and like her father said to her, "Did you enjoy that?" And she said, "Oh yeah, that was really good." And they leant across and said, "Oh, that was pen such and such." And that was the last time I think pork was served in the house. So yes, I mean, I think, you know, basically the pigs went to the meat market and they were slaughtered there and then sold on.
Sadly, towards the end, we actually had some people that we knew. I think it was Nicholson as well, because my mother was very, I mean, it wasn't just a case, they were just animals, and it was my mother got very, well, we all got attached to them, because we used to actually have pets. Yeah, maybe they'll run to the litter. You take it in the house, and of course, they ended up at Folly about the pig farm. We'd one called Oscar, but sadly, its mother had kind of lay in it, so it actually crinked net. So it was like a dog.
I found that a wee while ago.
Oh, Chico, aye.
And a pig.
A pig, yeah.
On the couch.
I mean, half the time, the house with the big roaring fires had either cats lying in front of it or pigs that were... or various other animals as well. So it was just like a proper farm, except it was in the inner cities.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't believe that there was a functioning, sizable pig farm in Glasgow.
And a way back, I always remember that as well. That was another thing that came, and it was basically foot and mouth. Foot and mouth disease hit,
and
it was a big, serious one. Well, the council in those days wanted to basically, I think, do a call basically, come in, and my grandfather wouldn't let them in. And he basically said, and nobody was allowed in, nobody was allowed out, but they did the disinfectant thing with the boots and the hay in front of the, if trucks did come in, they go through that, they got washed down. And he fought that tooth and nail, and he ended up getting the backing of the local police. And and he basically chased the councils away. They just wanted to come in and say, right, no, this is not, it's, and basically, I always can remember that because of the smell of the disinfectant to this day.
Yeah.
And it was probably three times stronger than it should have been. It probably could have set the hay on fire. It was that strong. But I think that's where my mother got, and so did Kiki out my grandfather. He was, sadly, I didn't really know my aunt, my granny, because I was so young. I can vaguely just, but she was a very gentle person, we were told.
She was a draftswoman by trade, which again was very unusual, you know, for a woman in the early 19s. But of course, she got married in the 1920s.
From Easdale as well.
Yeah. How they met, I don't know. I mean, how that came about.
I used to take my mother up to Easdale, and she still had the old pictures of Easdale from my granny's days. And actually on Easdale Island itself, is it Seal Island?
It's just off a seal, yeah.
Is it? I can't remember, but I was going to get them mixed up. They tried to open the wee museum there, and it was run by the locals. And there's only one wee pub in there.
The Puffer.
And the woman there was that interested. She actually took the pictures my mother had. She could recognise them, and she says, "Can I keep them? I'll look after them. I'll get them copied." And it was a great day out, because I took my mother up. She loved the drive up.
Yeah.
I mean, she could point things out over the Bridge of the Atlantic. She loved that. They used to say, "We'll cross Atlantic." Used to tell us the stories, and every so often I'd just be in the car and we would go, because you can do it in a day, up and down in a day.
Yeah.
It became very touristy as well, but she could tell, was it the slate mines? The slate mines were the same night as the disaster over the other side, so a lot of people lost their jobs because of the slate mines flooded and all that stuff. I mean, she goes back and remembers all that with her granny type of thing, but...
You mentioned... as well earlier on, the deli. You said something about the deli. Now, what was the deli?
Oh, the dairy.
Toll Cross had a wee dairy, as in you went up there and they got the butter, and the butter wasn't pre-packed. It was all, you know, padded about and you're given it that way. And Jenny Dougal was her name. I mean, she was a worldie from Toll Cross, but it was like the local hub. It was, she lived in the shop at the back. She did a fire and all that stuff. And she'd love, because I think, sadly, I didn't really know him, but the husband died quite young.
Yeah.
I think, and she just stayed until Cross, but she was, she must have lasted till God knows when. It was one of these ones that, because it was on Corbett Street, the main shop was in Toll Cross, but there was a wee alleyway with a door in it. You could go up at any time at night time, 7:30, 8:30, go and shop it, because you'd be sitting at the fire. She didn't have a TV, listen to a radio, and you could go in and she'd just say, go into the shop and help yourself. I'll get it written down in the morning type of thing. It was just, because my mother was a great baker, that was another thing. She loved baking. She'd maybe run out of something, you get sent up Corbett Street, go to Jenny's, and it could be 9 o'clock at night time. Mm-hmm. And you went up and got eggs and whatever it was.
I think that dairy must have been open till the 1980s.
Aye, yes.
Yeah.
Because sadly, with the same things, I don't know, she didn't really have much family kicking about. I think they were far away. But she, yeah. I mean, if she was alive today, by God, she could tell you a story or two, because she knew every day.
Everything.
As I said before, she knew it before it happened.
I think it's like that thing about Toll Cross, the village.
Well, that's what my mother used to say. Toll Cross is actually the toll on the cross. And I don't know if that's ever a true story, but that's how Toll Cross got its name. It was down at the Welshett Road and Toll Cross. And that was where, obviously, well before our times. But my mother used to say, if you look at history, it should be, that's a toll on the cross. So hence Toll Cross.
A little bit more about your Aunt Kiki then. What else did she do? She worked in the office.
She ran the office for the business, and then when the pigs were sold off, and they set up a sort of little property business, she ran that. But she also became a designer. She did a lot of knitting, and it was all wool stuff. Mm. So she sold to Frasers and a lot of high end stores. Very successful business she had there, but she would never scale it up.
Right.
Because she didn't think anybody could do what she did. So it was always just like she was a sole trader and that was it. But she was incredibly talented. She really was.
Still got the jumpers to this day. I mean,
still by, yeah.
Uh-huh. The famous one is at Gallatin Lyle.
I think I was a teenager at the time. I was a student. And Gallatin and Lyle were bringing out their album and they were going to call it Heart in My, the single, Heart in My Sleeve. And Kiki knew one of the mothers. So they phoned up Kiki and said, right, my son and his music partner want to get jumpers knitted with hearts in the sleeve for the cover album. And Kiki was just too busy. She couldn't do it. So the album ended up getting called Breakaway instead. And I was like, dash, I had to get a free copy of that album.
You know, I never forgave her for that one.
Skint student, that's all I was thinking about.
Gosh, there's so much that stands out from what you said. It's really, what an extraordinary story. The farm, the cars, and the people.
There were characters. In fact, when the Blythes were to tell, because obviously as rally drivers, they were members of the Royal Scottish Automobile Club. And that eventually closed down, I think, in the 1980s, and that building lay empty for a long time. But when the people that bought it and turned it into the Blythewood Hotel, they had they kept the motor scene. So I got in touch with them, and you know, I said, look, there's a lot of connections here. And they were like, oh, did you get any photographs? So I said, yeah, I'll lend you. I can't give you the photographs, but I'll lend them to you. And I had some of the rally plates as well. So In one of the parts of the Blythewood Hotel, there is a little section that's all pictures of Mother and Kiki in their rally days, which is nice. It sort of keeps them going in many ways.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. You think the volume of people that go through that building and will know that. That's lovely. That's absolutely lovely.
Yeah. They were a fascinating people, and they were very glamorous. Kiki was very blonde. My mother was a redhead. So they were very striking. You know, there's a brilliant picture I've got of them. It's in the ferry crossing when they're doing the Monte Carlo, and they're curled up and they're wearing these sort of like jumpsuit sort of things, very practical. And my mother's hands are covered in oil, but her nails are painted. Which I just love that. I just love it. And the makeup was on.
I think one of the stories in my grandfather's days, I mean, used to, it wasn't, you never asked, but he tried to get to the war. And obviously, every time we tried to get to the war, they sent them back because the pig farm was, it was paramount for to keep things going. And sadly, his brother, was it Andrew they called him, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We've still got the medal thing that you get from, sadly, when somebody passes away in the World War II. But for years, we didn't know this existed, but I came across it by accident. And it was a safe in the farm. And being inquisitive, I found a Smith & Wesson's revolver, army revolver, in the canvas case with the lanyard, the loop that goes in. It wasn't even the lanyard, it was the loop that went through. The cartridges were in the box with the greaseproof paper, but I never let on that I knew it was there. So, I mean, in those days, I'm not saying East End of Glasgow, there was guns kicking about, but then eventually, we joked about it one night, and I said, well, I know it's there, it's in the safe, what are we going to do with it? Because we could, so it was there for a couple of years. But the story my mother tells was his brother came home from the war, and evidently the war wasn't going too well. And he handed the gun to my grandfather, and he said, well, there's a gun. He says, there's the cartridges for it. And my grandfather evidently said to him, he says, what's use of that if a Panzer tank's coming down Corbett Street? And that was the way it was. That actually got quick. I'll finish that story real quickly. There was a gun that Amnesty came up in Glasgow, East End of Glasgow, London Road Police Station. So Kiki and mother went down in the car, and basically my mother went in, and she was the first one to hand in a gun into the police station. No other, they didn't know what to do with it.
A very, very old gun.
It was a very real gun, and eventually the poor constable that was on the desk had to get the chief superintendent down. She came down, didn't know what to do with it, got the CID down, who actually said to them was, do you know that's worth a fortune? My mother goes, it's getting handed in, it's you don't take names out. Oh no, and he actually opened it up, and he actually said, it's not been fired. My mother says, it's from World War II. They were fascinated with it, and of course my mother was in the police station that long, my poor aunt outside thought she'd been arrested. And as I say, for the East End of Glasgow, it wasn't bad because they said that was the first gun that was handed in. And it was this Smith & Wesson 38, I think it was called. I don't know. It was a hexagonal barrel because every time I see the war films, I'm like, Christ, we had one of them in the house, you know. Well, I got home that night and my aunt said, do not wind your mother up. She's had a hard day in the police station with a gun. And because, as Candy says, she used to be called Andy. So my mother comes in and says, how you doing? And I get your gun. And of course, she wouldn't speak to me for the rest of the night. She did eventually come round, but.
Thank you both so much for your time. It was absolutely brilliant to get a chance to meet up and talk with you. There's so, so much to say about your mother's life. What an absolutely incredible lady. If you want to see some photos of Andy's life and achievements, please do have a look at our website, where you'll be able to find some brilliant photos of the objects and articles about Andy's life that Candy and Donald have provided. Thank you both so much again. This episode of Tales for the East is presented in association with another artist in residence in Glasgow, Rebecca Fraser's Today Museum, whose project, Life, explores and archives what life is like in 2021 for the people of Shettleston through their stories and objects. For more information on Rebecca's work, please visit todaymuseumparkhead.com. That's todaymuseumparkhead.com. Thank you so much to Anne Dundas, Donald's wife, who rang me up to see if I'd be interested in these tales. Thank you, Anne. I certainly was. It was a brilliant suggestion. Tales for the East is an artist-in-residence project from Glasgow Life. I share the position with my friend, Mr. Tim Marozzo, who will be taking photo portraits in the very, very near future now that COVID restrictions have kind of lifted a bit. There's 7 episodes already out there for you to listen to, so do seek them out if you'd like to hear more. There are so many more tales to be told, so if you do know someone who knows tales of Denniston, Sight Hill or Hag Hill and you think they'd be willing to talk to us for the podcast, we'd love to talk to them. I'd also really, really like to speak to anyone from the diverse immigrant communities in the area, so please do feel to drop us a line at info@tales-fae-the-east.com with any contacts you think might be willing to talk. If you want to find us on social media, just type in Tales for the East and you should find us. Our website, tales-fae-the-east.com, gives you some more info about the project and provides links to subjects covered in the episodes. We're going to be offering Podcast and Photography. Yes, Podcast and Photography. We're going to be offering podcast and photography workshops very soon, so do drop us a line if you'd like to come along and join us. The workshops will be a mixture of specially made YouTube videos and Zoom tutorials, so they're accessible to all ages and all levels. Nisht, maha galik akit, nyo, ma vista yolach ir dunyus and be le shagalik on saskira, no, le skilin on saskira, on sagalik, ha ui mura ginya akapadich rut. So, if you have Gaelic or if you know anyone with Gaelic in the area, we'd love to talk to you about the role of Gaelic in the area as well. So, fiction jirach gasta. Mera husht mi gach giachting. Thank you for listening. I look forward to seeing you again soon. Mór an tang. Hi mi rís chif. See you again soon. Ta-ta-bye.